Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
And I just got up and gathered my kids and their blankets and grabbed whatever and ran out the door, and I saw the fire.
3 people died and 2 were injured in a fire at a Bethel housing complex. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, conservative gubernatorial candidates go after Governor Mike Dunleavy's record.
I was expecting to go down to Juneau and back him up. There was nobody to back up. He had abandoned the field. He was no longer in the fight.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Early this morning, a fire in Bethel killed 3 people and burned 2 units of an affordable housing apartment building. As KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports, residents awoke to the smell of smoke.
At the Association of Village Council President's Regional Housing Authority low-rent unit apartment complex in Bethel, many residents have been awake since 4 in the morning.
I kept smelling something burning, and I had guests at my place. I go, "Are you guys smoking cigarettes?" They said, "We don't smoke cigarettes." And we smell that too. So I went outside. I start seeing smoke coming out of that other apartment. And right away I go, 911, I called them.
Galen Frank lives in the unit next door to the 2 units that were destroyed. Frank and some neighbors escaped, but 3 people in one of the units were trapped inside the building and died. 2 additional people were taken to the hospital with injuries. That's according to the Bethel Fire Chief. Other residents reported hearing screams from the burning unit and said they saw at least 1 man jump from its second-story window. Most people evacuated from the nearby units when they smelled the smoke. In total, 6 units were impacted by the fire. In one of those apartments, next-door neighbor resident Michaela Mike said she got out in the nick of time.
My mom yelled and saying, there's a fire. And I just got up and gathered my kids and their blankets and grabbed whatever and ran out the door, and I saw the fire. If my mom wasn't there, I think I wouldn't have woke up.
Mike said she had to leave all her infant's necessities behind, but those items weren't her main concern. Right now, she's mourning the neighbors she knew and cared for who were lost in the fire.
They were really kind.
The president and CEO of AVCP Regional Housing Authority said they were temporarily relocating all of the affected residents into unoccupied units in the larger 31-unit complex. He also said that the building where the fire occurred is likely at least 3 decades old. Fire marshals from Anchorage are in Bethel investigating the cause of the fire and expect to have more details later this evening or tomorrow. The Bethel Fire Department said it could not release the names of the 3 people killed in the fire or the 2 people who suffered injuries. KYUK will release the identities of the victims once it has confirmed that the next of kin have been notified. The fire chief said the fire burned from at least 4 a.m. to late morning Friday. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
When Mike Dunleavy ran for governor 4 years ago, he was the conservative candidate, running far to the right of the incumbent. Now, as he vies for re-election, Dunleavy's got 2 well-funded candidates running to the right of him: Wasilla Representative Christopher Kirka and Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports on how the conservatives are hoping to set themselves apart.
The primary election on Tuesday, August 16th, is going to pare the list of 10 gubernatorial candidates to 4, and it's unlikely that Representative Kirka and Mayor Pierce can both survive. The challengers are trying to distinguish themselves from each other and from Governor Dunleavy, primarily on performance and commitment. At a recent campaign event in Willow, Pierce said Dunleavy's record shows a, quote, lack of urgency to get anything done.
I look at what the current administration's accomplished, and I think the list is short.
Under Dunleavy, Pierce says, the state budget has been out of kilter. He says after starting his mayoral term with a deficit, he put the Kenai Peninsula borough on a solid fiscal path. Pierce sees himself as more conservative than Dunleavy, but not as right-wing as Kirka.
You know, I'm not an extreme far-right Republican. I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican. I've lived by those principles in my life.
Pierce chose Edie Grunwald as his running mate. She's from the Matsu and rose to prominence as the mother of murder victim David Grunwald. They reported raising nearly $200,000. Kirka is a past board member and director of Alaska Right to Life, a nonprofit that advocates against abortion rights. He was first elected to the legislature 2 years ago. His running mate, Paul Huber of Homer, was part of a throng of Trump supporters who were at the U.S. Capitol during the January 6th attack, but says he did not go inside. The FBI later searched Huber's home in what turned out to be a case of mistaken identity. Kirka and Huber have raised close to $170,000. Kirka said Dunleavy hasn't lived up to promises he made ahead of his first term, such as delivering a so-called statutory permanent fund dividend and significantly reducing the state budget.
So when I got elected to the state house, I was expecting to go down to Juneau and back him up. There was nobody to back up. He had abandoned the field. He was no longer in the fight.
Dunleavy has raised far more than Kirka and Pierce, $1.7 million. He also has the endorsement of the Alaska Republican Party. In 4 years as governor, Dunleavy has backed off on some of the more aggressive policies he started office with. In 2018, he proposed a budget that would have cut state ferry system funding by more than two-thirds and made sharp spending reductions to the university system, public schools, and Alaska pioneer homes. The budget passed this year is the sixth largest in state history, in part because oil revenue is up. It includes a $3,200 PFD that's lower than what would have been set by state statute, but the highest on record. And while Dunleavy campaigned on a statutory PFD plus back pay, the thousands of dollars he felt Alaskans were owed since the previous administration vetoed part of the dividend, he is now pushing for a 50-50 plan that would split spending between Alaskans and the state government. Dunleavy disagrees with his opponent's characterizations.
I think I've kept my promises really well. Public safety, for example, we brought down the crime rate, and that's according to FBI statistics. With the exception of education and public safety, our agency budgets are lower than they were when I first got in. We navigated a pandemic without locking people in their houses or mandating masks or vaccines.
And Dunleavy says he's relying on his record.
I am sure there are people in the state that think I am very conservative. I'm sure there's probably a handful that don't think I'm conservative enough. But these are interesting questions. These are questions that rarely do we discuss because we're focused on governing for all of Alaska. And we're pretty confident and certain in as much as our grounding and our values and principles.
Dunleavy argues Kirka's year and a half as a legislator and Pierce's 5 years as a borough mayor don't compare to his experience as governor. He says it's like comparing apples and oranges. With help from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
The gubernatorial race also includes former governor and nonpartisan candidate Bill Walker, who made a campaign stop during Kodiak's Crab Fest weekend in late May. Former Alaska State Representative and Democratic candidate Les Guerra also campaigned in Kodiak in late July. KMXT's Dylan Samard spoke with each candidate and their running mates during their visits to the island and has this story.
Fisheries policy is one of the most pressing issues for many Kodiak voters, and former Governor Bill Walker says local fishermen need to be better represented on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees fisheries in Alaska's exclusive economic zone.
There's 11 seats on there, which Alaska has 6 and Washington has 5. So I want to make sure that we have people on there that know who they represent, that they're wearing our uniform, so to speak, the Alaska uniform.
Former State Representative Les Guerra argued that Governor Dunleavy's appointees to the council had not done enough to act in Alaska's interest.
The people that he nominated, they voted to not do anything about chum, salmon, bycatch in a year where fish are not going up the Kuskokwim.
Both candidates say that Kodiak is the poster child for renewable energy and support further development of renewable resources in Alaska. And when it comes to the Alaska Marine Highway system, each candidate agreed that it's a vitally important connection for rural coastal communities. Walker's running mate Heidi Dreigas was born in Fairbanks and moved to Juneau in 2015. She says it's given her a new perspective on the value of the ferry system.
It's frustrating to hear about the days of old when we had a vibrant marine highway system with, you know, in the 90s where we had a predictable schedule, the ships were in good working order.
Gera also wants to build a more reliable ferry system and blames present-day woes on the current governor.
I would reestablish a pre-Mike Dunleavy marine highway system, one that works, one that is affordable for people, one that has scheduled frequent marine highway stops. The marine highway is important to businesses. It's important for tourism. It's important for residents.
Kodiak is host to the largest Coast Guard base in the United States, and both candidates were asked about Arctic security. Walker says he wants the Coast Guard's new icebreakers to be homeported in Alaska instead of Seattle, and he also supports the construction of a Navy base in Alaska.
I have had conversations with the Secretary of the Navy, talking to him about the reopening of ADAC or another coastal port that provides a naval presence in Alaska. The response I got was that if there was a need or a concern, it would be covered. Alaska would be covered out of San Diego, which just didn't feel quite as urgent as I was interested in.
Gera says he's in favor of increasing the size of Alaska's Coast Guard presence.
We want to Alaskanize as much of this fleet as possible, from Homer to Nome to Juneau. There are harbor and port expansion needs that could help local communities first, but also be built in a way that could house the federal vessels.
Whether their stances resonate with voters is yet to be seen. The primary for Alaska governor is fast approaching on August 16th. Early voting has already begun in some Alaska communities, and absentee in-person voting started in Kodiak on August 1st. In Kodiak, I'm Dylan Simard.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, health officials address misconceptions about monkeypox.
Anyone can get monkeypox. This is not a gay virus. This is not a virus that's only been seen among gay people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Republican candidate Tara Sweeney filed to be a write-in candidate in Tuesday's special election to fill the remainder of late Congressman Don Young's term. Sweeney, a former Assistant Interior Secretary, finished fifth in the June special primary, just below the cutoff to have her name appear on the special general election ballot. Last month, she said she was shifting her focus to her campaign for the full two-year U.S. House seat. But on Thursday, Sweeney threw her hat into the special election ring after all. In a statement, she said she made the decision to enter as a write-in candidate after, quote, repeated requests from supporters asking for the option to support a candidate more closely aligned with their values and beliefs, end quote. Sweeney is among six certified write-in candidates in the election. The candidates with their names on the ballot are Republicans Nick Begich and Sarah Palin and Democrat Mary Peltola. Voters can rank a write-in candidate just as they would candidates whose names will appear on the ballot. Special election results are expected to be certified on September 2nd. Sweeney's campaign has raised almost $300,000. A separate independent group organized to support her election has raised more than $630,000. Tuesday is also primary election day for the two-year U.S. House term that begins in January. Sweeney's name will appear on the primary ballot along with 21 other candidates. Voters will pick one candidate on that ballot, and the top four vote-getters will advance to the general election in November. For the last year, Anchorage's mobile crisis team has been on the streets responding to mental health crises. A few months ago, it got funding to operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early spent a day with the team to see how they supplement public safety in the state's largest city and how this new funding will expand that work.
It's a Friday afternoon, and Anchorage's mobile crisis team has just received a call from dispatch.
Sounds like possibly a panic attack. that's happening just down the street from us, actually.
That's Jennifer Pierce, a licensed clinician and part of a two-person team tasked with addressing mental health crises in Anchorage. The team's gray SUV pulls into the parking lot of Rani 2, a sushi restaurant on the east side. Pierce and her partner, paramedic Michael Riley, find a woman in her car. She tells Riley she has a history of anxiety-induced panic attacks, but this time it's worse.
She actually expressed that the anxiety is different this time, that she has not had it, it has not felt like this before, and the chest pain is feeling different.
An ambulance is also on scene, and it's determined that the woman should be taken to a hospital. Responding to calls like this, where someone is in mental health duress, is what the mobile crisis team is all about. The idea is that it's a better way to address mental health emergencies. The team of first responders not only takes some of the pressure off of police and firefighters who may have responded in the past, but they can also connect people with the most appropriate resources. So far, Riley says it seems to be working.
With over 1,000 911 calls we've responded to now, so calls that have come through the 911 system, 800 of those stayed in the community. That's 800 calls that didn't go to an emergency service, didn't go to the ED, or didn't go to a jail. So that's impact on the emergency services and frees up space for that.
That doesn't include responses to calls coming into the 311 non-emergency line. Dispatchers who answer the 311 and 911 calls are trained in emergency medical services and basic anatomy, so they can decide what calls go to the mobile crisis team, or MCT. It's key that the team has both a paramedic and a clinician, says Riley. Paramedics like him take the lead on situations that require immediate medical attention.
By having a medic on the team, we could make first contact, evaluate, and say, yes or no, this isn't primarily medical, or yes, it was in this instance, and then we could hand off to the medic rig.
For cases dealing with mental health crises, a clinician like Pierce takes the lead. As they leave the sushi restaurant, the MCT gets another call. A man named Michael Joseph says a young man he's known for years with a history of psychiatric issues is having a crisis at Centennial Park Campground.
Naked in the woods, incoherent, out of his mental, distraught. Just a pair of boots on. That's all.
It's the first call to the campground the MCT has received since it became a makeshift homeless camp last month following the closure of the Sullivan Arena shelter by Mayor Dave Bronson. By the time the team arrives, the young man is clothed and sitting at a bench. Pierce sits down to talk to him.
He was willing to talk to me. We had a good conversation and willing to kind of communicate his needs.
Pierce says sometimes these talks mean helping people get their medication or working on breathing exercises to reduce stress or just talking about what led to their breakdown. Pierce says on average she spends about 30 minutes with a person during a response, but it really varies.
I've been with someone for 3 hours or I've been with someone for 5 minutes. They just needed like a little check-in and they were good and they were like, I'm good to go, thank you. So it really depends.
After Pierce talks to the man at Centennial, city park officials step in to take him to a main office and connect him with resources. Pierce says the MCT will check on him the following day.
Just to check in and make sure that he has all the resources that he needs to stay out here where he wants to be safely.
Joseph is watching the response unfold. He says he'd never heard of the mobile crisis team before he was transferred to them by dispatch. He's glad they arrived.
They were very concerned and very gracious and very professional and very wanting to help and get all the information and anything they could do to help this young man without saying his name. So I'm really so thankful they came here. It's great. And now maybe this young man will get some help that he needs so desperately.
Riley says he finds that since he, Pierce, and the other MCT members aren't police officers, it can be easier in some ways to respond to mental health calls.
You know, we love our brothers in blue, absolutely, but that has broken down barriers when they were like, we're not police. That's not the angle we're coming at. We're a licensed clinician and a paramedic. We're here to help with, you know, what's going on right now.
In total, the MCT team responded to 8 calls that day. Most were in East Anchorage, though Pierce says in the past she's driven all over town.
We would be all deep south Anchorage, and then we got a call in Eagle River. And then we got a call all the way in West Anchorage, and then we had a call in Eagle River. So we put a lot of miles on the car that day.
Currently, the mobile crisis team operates for 10 hours a day, between 10 a.m. and 8 p.m., 7 days a week. In April, the Anchorage Assembly put money towards funding the MCT for 24/7 service. The funding was finalized in May after Mayor Bronson vetoed the funding and the Assembly overrode him. Pierce says she's looking forward to the team expanding. There have been times when the MCT is so slammed, more traditional responders like police have had to take the calls. She thinks working overnight will be a huge help for the community.
We can help people who are feeling suicidal in the middle of the night, right? Or having an anxiety attack or not knowing where to turn or what to do, and to say, hey, we're here for you, even in the middle of the night, right? You have support.
Riley says it'll likely be a while before the team is fully staffed, but they say the funding could even go towards funding a second MCT vehicle to respond during high call volume times. For now, people can call 911 or 311 and request the mobile crisis team anytime they need mental health support. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
An Anchorage nonprofit expects to receive monkeypox vaccines in the coming weeks. In the meantime, they're educating community members about the virus and addressing misconceptions about how it spreads. Dr. Tracy Weiss is the clinical director at Identity Health Clinic, a nonprofit that serves the LGBTQ community in Anchorage. At a virtual town hall meeting last night, she said the monkeypox virus has an incubation period of 1 to 2 weeks. Two people in Alaska have tested positive for monkeypox so far.
So we suspect that those two folks have probably had some kind of contact with other folks in their lives. And it's possible that other people are incubating the virus as we speak.
Monkeypox is spread during prolonged face-to-face or skin-to-skin contact. It's not exclusively spread through sexual contact, but that's how most infected people are catching it, according to the World Health Organization.
Anyone can get monkeypox. This is not a gay virus. This is not a virus that's only been seen among gay people. The reason why we're focusing outreach within this community is simply that many of the reported cases have fallen within this community. So the natural thing to do then is to target outreach to those communities. But this isn't like a virus that's only being spread because gay people are having sex with other gay people.
Infected people may have flu-like symptoms before a rash or sores. State epidemiologist Dr. Joan McLaughlin says people can spread the virus to others even before the rash appears.
You can have respiratory symptoms like runny nose, things that just seem like a cold or, you know, even COVID or the flu. And there's probably virus in those fluids. And so what CDC is saying is transmission is possible through that route, but it probably requires prolonged, kissing and close face-to-face contact for that transmission to occur.
Weiss says people who become infected should isolate themselves until their symptoms improve or disappear entirely. The rash should be well covered until it's completely healed. Last week, the state expanded vaccine eligibility beyond just confirmed cases and their recent close contacts. Now men and transgender people who have sex with men and have had multiple or anonymous sexual partners in the last 14 days can get the vaccine. People in that group should talk to their healthcare provider about getting vaccinated, especially if they're immunocompromised. In Anchorage, the city's health department has a limited vaccine supply available. Identity expects to receive a supply of doses sometime in the next 2 weeks. Visitors from around the world travel to Katmai National Park for an incredibly up-close experience with bears feeding on salmon runs. But the experience is a delicate balance of enthusiasm, crowd control, public education, and protocols to keep both visitors and bears safe. KDLG's Corinne Smith visited the popular tourist destination and has his story.
Visitors arrive at the beach at Brooks Camp and Katmai National Park either by jet boat or float plane. Tourists pepper captains and park rangers with nervous questions before being ushered into the visitor center to watch an orientation video.
The number one way to protect bears and people is by properly managing your food.
The 8-minute video prepares visitors for a one-of-a-kind park experience among bears feeding on healthy sockeye salmon runs along the Brooks River. All food items and gear are put into storage at Brooks Camp. Visitors walk along gated viewing platforms above the river. Below, bears roam or play or fish, and at the famous Brooks Falls, bears stand and snatch leaping sockeye from the water. Savik Ford and her family are visiting from New York City, and it's their first time in Alaska, the 50th state they visited together. They've been at Brooks Camp for 5 days.
You know, the first thing that you see when you go is just like, oh my God, bears, bears, everywhere. There are so many bears. And then, you know, when you get to go back over a course of a few days, you get to start to see who they are, like individually. You start to get to see like their individual behaviors and their fishing strategies.
Glenn Curtis is an Anchorage-based pilot with a group at the Brooks Falls platform. He's been doing day trips to Brooks Falls for the last 47 years.
There's nothing else like this in the world. I do guided tours here. I bring people from all over the world here. And there's nothing else like this that I know of anywhere in the world. And people send me Christmas cards 6 months from now because they're still thinking about this.
He says when he started coming in 1975, there was just a sheet of plywood on the bank of the river, no railing or infrastructure.
We didn't realize how risky it was, I guess, but we used to sit right over here and eat our lunch and watch the bears.
The development of Brooks Camp, park rangers, and safety protocols are to keep both people and bears safe. Visitation is steadily increasing, says Park Superintendent Mark Sturm. The park reduced capacity due to COVID concerns the past 2 years, and this year is fully open. Sturm says the crowds are challenging, but they take measures like 30-minute time slots for the viewing platforms.
It's not like it's the Grand Canyon where you have, vistas in all kinds of different locations and you can spread people out. Everyone that comes here is essentially hoping to get to the falls, and so it's a very condensed location everyone's trying to get to.
About 80 park staff and volunteers monitor walkways and platforms throughout the camp, making sure bears and people keep a healthy distance. Sturm says the bears are used to having people around, but the park works to prevent any surprises and keep the flow of people predictable.
We tend to let the bears behave naturally and then try to manage the people movement around them.
Sturm says how the park can accommodate an increasing number of visitors each year is uncertain. He says the park is planning to look at infrastructure improvements and whether limits on crowds should be set, a process likely to start next year. In Dillingham, I'm Corinne Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We have reports tonight from Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Kavitha George and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Dylan Samard in Kodiak, and Corinne Smith in Dillingham. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.